Worried about your future in tech? Master new skills, accelerate your team's impact, and redefine what's possible with Pluralsight. We're more than just another online learning platform. We're shattering the skills gap and shaping future generations of technologists. Transform your work. Transform your team. Ready to tap in? Visit us at Pluralsight.com to learn more.
It's The Wonky Show. There's 140 applications for every graduate job. We'll discuss the implications of that. OFS is going to survey students on sexual misconduct. Is a league table coming? And there's new national student splits for NSS data. It's all coming up.
A student from nearby Feltham said to me, "So how are you going to hold my hand through all of this, Julie?" Well, this is one of the ways. And they're brilliant. They're brilliant ambassadors. They're really good in the work that they take on. And so we shut that option off at our peril.
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Jim Dickinson, and here to crack down on rip-off podcasts, as usual, three top-flight guests. In leafy Egham, Julie Sanders is Vice-Chancellor and Principal at Royal Holloway University of London. Julie, your highlight of the week, please.
So, obviously, I have no life, so it's definitely work-based, but actually, it's our Campus Unity Week, and our brilliant Festival of Languages and Culture is taking place, which is a partnership between our student union and colleagues, and it's just an absolute moment of joy and community building. So, food, music, and lots of chat in multiple languages.
Fantastic, particularly the food. So good stuff. Some links in the show notes. In Canterbury, Joe Cooper is Director of People and Culture at the University of East London. Joe, your highlight of the week, please.
My highlight of the week was actually sitting down with my eldest daughter and helping her finish her personal statement for her application to Unity, which was simultaneously a kind of really important positive life cycle moment, but obviously utterly depressing in terms of how old I feel.
Let's hope someone actually reads it. And in South Holland this week, Michael Salmon is news editor at Wonky. Michael, your highlight of the week, please.
Morning, Jim. I've been racking my brain about what my highlight of the week will be, to the extent that I haven't prepared as much as I would have for the rest of the podcast, and I just couldn't think of anything. So roll on the weekend.
Well, there we go. So we'll start this week with graduate jobs. Competition for graduate jobs has reached a record high, according to the Institute of Student Employers. Michael, what's going on here?
Yeah, so this is one of these sort of data points that really makes me think. I'm very thankful and privileged to not be a student graduating right now. It's the same as whenever we think about the student finance system. So we get these stories in the papers sort of semi-regularly, especially in the Times and the Telegraph, that it's becoming harder and harder for recent graduates to find work. The recruitment market is much more cutthroat. You know, there's so much more competition. Everyone wants the jobs. No one can get them. Sometimes it's sort of this, you know, ties into sort of, is university worth it? Sometimes it's a bit more sympathetic to these students who are actually sort of struggling to find work. But yeah, this report from the Institute of Student Employers, or the ISE, is really interesting. It's, you know, as opposed to just sort of anecdotes, it's actually a big survey from all these different, you know, big and small employers of and recruiters of students. It had more than 40,000 students hired by these companies. So it's quite a good slice of the market. And there's a very good blog on Wonky this morning from Stephen Isherwood, who's the Joint Chief Exec, which really sort of does a good job of picking out the highlights. Yeah, as you said, the kind of headline, and this has been picked up in the papers this morning too, is that last year, amongst these employers surveyed, there were 140 applications per vacancy for graduate jobs, as we sort of think about them, which is a lot in itself. I mean, that really is a lot. There's a lot of disappointed applicants, and it's also a mega increase on the previous year. It's about sort of 60% up from 2022-23. And they suggest there's a couple of sort of reasons that might be at the heart of this. One is that, you know, more students are applying because fewer and fewer jobs require firsts or 2-1s or certain A-level results or certain UCAS tariffs. So, which is a good thing, you'd think. I mean, there's a wider pool of applicants, and so there's more applications. And they also think that it could be something to do with AI, you know, students are able to sort of bash CVs and cover letters together more quickly, fire off loads of applications, not always of the best quality, but, you know, there's a, this sort of AI-driven deluge of sort of things being shot out there and recruiters having to deal with. Yeah, so as I said, it's one of these ones that makes me think I'm very pleased that I'm not a graduate trying to look for my first job right now.
Yes, yeah, so, and Michael, just before I bring everyone else in, obviously when there's a ratio like this, my first question is, well, is this, you know, fewer jobs or more students? But you're saying that one of the things they highlight in there is people just sort of banging in an application. Is that right?
Yeah. So they've said, according to their members, there has still been a small increase in the number of vacancies, you know, the number of jobs out there, although employers are not expecting this to rise very much in the coming year. You know, they're seeing the recruitment market tightening. It's sort of, you know, it's loosened and tightened and loosened again post-pandemic. But there was also something in the Financial Times this morning, another data source, I can't remember from where they were suggesting that they're already across the whole graduate recruitment market, there has already been a kind of downturn in the number of positions available. But yeah, the ISE report really does say it seems like students are just getting a lot more applications in. There's a lot more candidates chasing every role.
Interesting. Now, Julie, I was on, for my sins, LBC last night, where, you know, there are too many people going to university was broadly the theme of the hour, as usual, for various taxi drivers arguing that there are. But one of the sort of slow drum beats of press coverage that we tend to kind of half listen to is lots and lots of employers saying, well, we're going to drop the need to have a degree in order to come and work for us. Should that worry the sector?
It's a really complicated thing, isn't it? Because as Michael said, there's an extent to which there's a real positive in here about widening pools of applicants, and we're seeing the rise in applications for different levels of entry to roles. And part of that is about equality, diversity and inclusion, hiring practices. You know, there has been a big shift in companies. But I think it does worry me. It worries me that this pressure on students that we've already alluded to is just immense. And actually, if you read through the ISE report, it was such a strong emphasis from the employers on the skills they need, actually in some cases very satisfied in terms of what they're getting from university students, from graduates, etc. So I think we need to hear some of that and get the employers to actually speak much more openly about that, about what that skills pathway is. But I still really worry, you know, as someone who's absolutely out there banging the drum for inclusive education, I feel like some of the things in this report are really showing it that everything is compounded as a problem for our so-called widening participation students. You know, the kinds of students who are facing intersectional challenges that we're going to be discussing right through this podcast, I suspect. I mean, we're doing work at Royal Holloway with Purpose Coalition and had Justine Greening here, former Minister for Education, giving a lecture in our For What Matters series. But, you know, she spoke really eloquently about the kind of the difficulty of who has the confidence to navigate all of this, even to know what they don't know in making applications, let alone when you put artificial intelligence and everything that brings on top. So I am worried about, on the one hand, it's about a widening of access in all sorts of ways to careers through different pathways. And that's absolutely all well and good. But actually, there's a risk that we're narrowing the university sector and outcomes. And it's so counterproductive. And I hear such anxiety about this at open days from prospective students. And it's absolutely beholden on us as universities. We've got to be in there right from day one, alongside thinking about these skills and pathways and opportunities right through the degree.
Yeah. Joe, obviously you, you know, you're a big HR supremo. And when I was thinking when I was reading this, when we recruited at Team Wonky, Livia, comparing to when we recruited Mac, and we got about five times as many applications when we recruited Mac. But when we'd done Sift 1, which was, you know, get rid of the ones that are three-line applications and ones that were breathtakingly obviously written by AI, then actually the number of applications was broadly the same. Is that happening? Is that happening in roles in universities?
Well, firstly, let me just give me a moment while I change my email signature to HRC Primo. Thank you. but the short answer is yes. We are seeing a trend in the a higher amount of applications per role. I was actually looking at our data in just in terms of applications for all roles at UEL. Got up in 2 years, I've gone up by 50%. So we had 11,000 applications for roles compared to 7,000 2 years before. That's actually something we've tried to increase, but there's definitely something going on there. The key piece of data I think that's missing from the paper is, although the amount, I agree with Julie, there's a concerning narrative around it, so I'm not disagreeing with that at all. But what it's telling us is the amount of applications per role. What it's not telling us is how many applications each individual graduate is putting in. So it doesn't quite tell exactly how many disappointed individuals there are. It just tells us how many applications that don't land. So to your point, in terms of the initial quality of them, I think that's part of the picture. Certainly think that AI is part of that picture as well. There's something around making sure that those initial stages of recruitment are a little bit different. I don't actually have a problem with AI as a tool for recruitment, but I think if you go back to your experience, Jim, what I'm sure you were looking for in those applications was a bit of a personal touch in both directions. So an understanding that the applicants really understood the role and Wonky really wanted to do it, but also you really felt you understood that individual by virtue of the application. So thinking about a more kind of personal approach to the application process earlier on, I think would shift the dial in terms of those numbers. I guess the other thing I wanted to point out we don't really see who's losing out. So I was looking at the numbers in the report in terms of those minimum criteria. They're quite stark over a sort of 10 years. So having no minimum standard for graduate jobs is up to 23%. So 23% of employers don't have a minimum entry requirement. That's up from 8% over 10 years. 10 years ago, 74% of employers wanted a 2-1, and that's down to 46. So those are quite big numbers. But so that's, to Julie's point, that's really positive. But what we don't really see from the data is, are the unsuccessful applicants from the people that might have been walking into it by virtue of their degree course 10 years ago or not?
Yeah, okay, fascinating. And Michael, there's another story in here, isn't there, about international students?
This was probably the thing that most jumped out at me, actually, because, you know, this is the clearest thing where we can see there's been a policy change, and that really looks quite clearly to have been an impact. So, you know, as listeners will know, back in April, let me just do that again while I cough. So as listeners will know, back in April, the previous government raised the salary threshold for the skilled worker visa. It had been, you know, in sort of broadest terms, it had been about sort of 26,000. They raised it all the way up to 38,000. I mean, there are lots of discounts for things like, you know, for younger sort of graduates and things like that. But it's become much, much harder to get a skilled worker visa, you know, especially for sort of entry level graduate jobs. There's not many that are paying in the sort of, you know, 35 plus grand a year. And the data shows it here. So, you know, of the 63 organizations that answered the question about, you know, sort of hiring of international students, 30% of them said they would be decreasing the number of international students they hired. 18% had already rescinded job offers that they'd made earlier in the year, and then this policy change came in and they realized, you know, either we have to offer this person a much higher salary or we need to, you know, or we won't be able to get them a visa. And, you know, that's terrible, right? We sort of read about that over the summer. You know, there'd be the odd story about, you know, KPMG has been forced to revoke offers to international students because the starting salary is too low. But yeah, very, very depressing. And it also clearly has an impact on the graduate route, right? Because, I mean, the graduate route doesn't have a salary threshold, but the idea, in theory at least, is that students should be able to come, go into entry-level work with no salary threshold. That's great. It's a sort of permissive route in, you know, but the aspiration of a lot of students, and I think policymakers, right, back when they sort of had a plan for the graduate route, was that this would, you know, allow people to get experience and then work their way up into more senior roles and transfer over to the skilled worker visa. This year, that has become so much more difficult. And, you know, if the graduate route stops being that kind of route into, you know, a longer term career in sort of really interesting and important roles, then what's it for?
Do you know, Julie, I find this fascinating, partly because a couple of weeks ago, I was looking at international education strategies around the world. And notwithstanding the fact that Canada have just capped the number of international students, it just felt like there's a much more grown up debate about the skills needs of the economy in the future and where international students and then people who will then settle in Canada provider fit into that sort of mix? And I'm compare that to the, you know, the conversation on LBC last night, and there just feels like a complete lack of real clarity or strategy around the skills we're going to need in the next 5, 10, 15 years, unless I read the UUK blueprint, and that will obviously come from a particular perspective.
I think that's right, Jim. And you know, it's interesting, you know, if you look at that ISU report and the really high demand areas, we know that many of our international students are coming from countries with fantastic skills and growth opportunities in that area as well. But they're coming to the UK to increase their skills. That can only be good in multiple route ways. And I think there's one way of thinking about the UK's own skills need, but there's a risk also of thinking of most companies aren't walled off from a global context. I'm just back from a working trip to China, and absolutely fantastic to see the power in action of an alumni community to help each other actually as an enabling network, but also just to understand the kind of heat map of global companies in the room. They're working across languages, they're working in different ways. So that skills base is kind of local and global. And I think we sometimes lose that in the debate as well. But I do think, I mean, I feel for the international students, I think, because one of the things we do, a US chancellor once said to me in a very eloquent way, you know, we break their network. How are we helping them during their time with us? Yes, to look for employment here, but also they're interested in their, you know, work back in their own countries, but that has that global reach. And there's so much more nuanced discussion we should be having about all of this, really.
Joe, just back on this AI. Now, I don't want to set hairs running here. I'm not suggesting that, you know, I'm thinking of replacing Mac with AI, or that, you know, UEL is thinking of replacing staff with AI. But, you know, one of the things that strikes me about all of this is that, again, one of the drumbeat of press coverage, press reports on AI more generally, is this idea that what companies might be doing is, you know, replacing bottom of the rung positions that were often taken up by new graduates with technology and AI. You know, do you get a sense, not necessarily even in the HE sector, but more widely, perhaps in, you know, across HR roles across the country, the people you network with, perhaps outside of HE, that people are really starting to, cut some of those bottom rungs of the ladder off?
That's a good question. Probably not at the graduate level yet. And I'm really sort of thinking sort of anecdotally about what's sort of happening in the kind of HR sector rather than more broadly in the graduate sector. But I think that will come, right? As to be honest, I think we're all grappling with harnessing AI in a positive way. And we're probably, being higher education institutions, a little bit behind some other organizations. I think the trick is trying to get ahead of that both in terms of my line of work, but also thinking about the skills agenda for graduates. And actually, going back to the report, there's some weird things happening around roles around digital IT. So they've got the highest applications, so 205 applications to one. But if you're going to go a bit earlier into the report, something we're not talking about is that in the same sector, there's been a 46% drop in internships and a 25% drop in graduate placement students. So the demand, supply demand challenge within IT roles, there's something weird going on there. So I think there's clearly some kind of transition that needs to happen in terms of the skills we're providing for graduates and how they relate to harnessing AI and what they're actually coming out with at the moment.
Now, just before we come off this, we shouldn't completely ignore, on a related matter, the Employment Act that came out last week. And Michael, we actually don't have a ban on unpaid internships, do we? We have a consultation.
Yeah, that aspect of things has been very much kicked into the long grass. It was originally in the run-up to the election and even further back, you know, Labour were saying a ban on unpaid internships was one among the many reforms they were going to make to employment. And yeah, last week, was it now? Yeah, a week ago today, the Employment Act was published, the bill, and has sort of begun its process in Parliament. But there's lots of stuff that where they've just said, you know, this is our longer term aspirations, possibly, you know, legislation much later in Parliament, but or even into a second term now. So they very much avoided, you know, there's been a lot of pushback to the Act, right, from both from employers and commentators and sort of saying, you know, this is going to add burden burden onto businesses, and won't someone think of the SMEs and all this kind of stuff. And yeah, unfortunately, I think unpaid internships is sort of one of the bits that's been a casualty of that. It's you know, they've said there'll be, as you say, some consultation or some further work and some employer engagement, of course. Hopefully, you know, some engagement with the actual people suffering through needing to get internships, but yeah, perhaps not.
Julie, I guess the clutch of stuff in there that will be of particular relevance to universities and students' unions, actually, as employers, is some of the stuff on 0 hours contracts, where, you know, the headlines really are that the government takes the view that there's too much flexibility on the employer side. Now, you know, when you do the surveys, students actually quite like the flexibility of 0 hours contracts. And, you know, for example, there's nothing in the Employment Act on seasonal employers. So as I've been saying to people, you know, if you sell pumpkins or Christmas trees, or you run a student union or university, you probably don't want to be paying students for as many hours over Christmas or the summer as perhaps you are during term time. Do we need the government to, you know, scrape together a proper student employment strategy?
Can I just say, yes, absolutely. It's really interesting. I've been really struck by how important, we talk about universities as anchor institutions all the time, and we talk about them as employers in the local community. But actually, one of the great ways we can operate and enable students to gain the kind of skills that we're talking about, you know, during learning, support the cost of learning, which we know is immense and intense for our students, but also actually just run a really good sector with great student unions, etc., is through employment on campus. And to do that, well, that needs flex, that needs understanding, because as you say, the feedback from students, and you know, I put postgraduate research students into that mix as well, you want to do some teaching but don't want to be locked into everything that a full-time employment contract brings with it. And so I think really I'm trying to understand the sector and get underneath that, because I think there's something brilliant we can do here that really helps those students we were talking about earlier who need us to be in alongside. Something a student from nearby Feltham said to me, so how are you going to hold my hand through all of this, Julie? Well, this is one of the ways. And they're brilliant ambassadors, they're really good in the work that they take on. And so, you know, we shut that option off at our peril. So I think a student employability strategy would be really, really welcome.
Hopefully some civil servants from the business department, some civil servants from DfE will meet up at some point and chat and maybe produce something. So anyway, plenty on all of this on the site as ever. For now, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, I'm Kate Black, Head of Education at Newcastle Business School. And this week on Wonky, I've been blogging about academics' identities in interdisciplinary experiential learning. I've been looking at how successful interdisciplinary experiential learning must necessarily address not only structural constraints imposed by timetabling, room capacities and the like, but also the emotional response of academics. My research within identity studies would suggest that when academics step outside of their discipline, so their identity is threatened and the natural response is a fierce reassertion of that disciplinary identity. Therefore, rather than coming together, there's a risk that academics are pushed further apart. Experiential learning in itself may also challenge academics' identities, as they must follow their learners unscripted rather than create the learning space that they themselves envisage. And this too may result in a further reassertion of their disciplinary identity. Without doubt, interdisciplinary pedagogies are vital for addressing the global grand challenges. However, we need to be aware of the implications for academics' identities and in turn their well-being and effectiveness of educators. Addressing the structural constraints comprises only a very small part of the picture.
Now, next up, the Office for Students has announced the launch of a pilot prevalence survey into sexual misconduct. Julie, what's happening here?
Okay, so the Office for Students has announced this pilot survey into prevalence of sexual misconduct and harassment in universities to run in 2025. That means in practice that all final year undergraduate students in England will be invited to complete a short online survey after completing the National Student Survey, the NSS, and opt-out is possible. It's not yet clear how any findings or data will be shared. And obviously, that's crucial to understand, because, you know, obviously, the aims here are to learn more about that student experience at both provider and national level. And John Blake, Lead for Fair Access at the Office for Students rightly stresses that students have been raising this as a major concern for them, as they have for universities. So the survey is a first step in a body of work by the regulator, hopefully in close partnership with universities, to ensure that students are best protected and supported. It's all ahead, of course, of the full introduction of the new condition E6 on harassment and sexual misconduct. It is, as I mentioned, it's Office for Students, so it's England. Interestingly, the devolved nations have expressed an interest, so they're watching this space, as they say. But I do think important we learn more soon about how any findings are going to be shared quickly and thoughtfully across the sector if we're going to really make an informed and thoughtful response.
Now, Michael, you were in the press call with John Blake, weren't you? And the thing that I can't understand is, it was surely obvious that the first question from you would be, well, you're going to publish the data. Is it going to be published nationally at institution level? You know, what granular? That is obviously going to, and there wasn't an answer, was there? They don't know yet, which does beg the question, why announce it without knowing that?
Yeah, and we can note that the press release that was published, it was published sort of midday last Friday, does say more details will come later this month. That's October, if you're listening back in the future. So, you know, we'll see. But it is a little bit odd. And, you know, John was being quite thoughtful about this and clear that he is certainly mindful of some of the things Julie's just mentioned around, you know, there's all kinds of issues in terms of, you know, kind of legal and data protection issues when we're talking about sensitive issues. There's this sort of specter of, you know, are the tabloids going to start running sexual misconduct leak tables if things get published publicly? If they don't get published publicly, surely we'll still just be able to do Freedom of Information Act requests and get it. So, you know, it is being considered. It's a little bit odd that it was announced in this way, but, you know, I think ultimately, you know, that's a problem and a question for Wonky, but in the wider scope, if we get some further information in the next 2-3 weeks, it doesn't really matter. Interesting. And as I think the wider point it speaks to is that there are lots of issues with, okay, what is going to happen with this data when we get it?
I mean, Joe, if you take this at face value, one of the reasons why we have a national student survey is that it highlights, you know, particular problems in particular providers, and then gives providers data, you know, either by subject area or by student characteristic, to know where they should put their particular effort in terms of those aspects of the student experience that are covered in the survey. So at least in theory, of course, all of the data should be public, shouldn't it? But presumably there would be unintended consequences.
Short answer is yes. And that was exactly my concern. I mean, putting aside the kind of how the data is going to be presented and distributed, but that's an issue in itself, right? Because the idea that you would decide to capture this kind of sensitive information without having a view or sort of discussing exactly what's going to be captured, how it's going to be disseminated, who's going to see it, I'm just finding quite challenging. But more important is that how is it going to be useful to actually address some of the underlying issues at a sector and an institutional level? I guess the other side to it, and correct me if I misunderstood, but if this is going to be tacked on to the NSS, does that mean we're only going to be capturing the experiences from third year undergraduates? Because that's significantly limiting in terms of really kind of understanding the issues, the kind of high risk areas, and actually what we can really do to address it. Because the object isn't kind of produce a leak table to kind of shame people. It's actually for us to really, you know, understand the issues and tackle some of the challenges around sexual misconduct. So if we're not going to kind of get data from international students or first year undergraduates leaving home for the first time, I mean, the gaps in the data and the insight are going to be huge, aren't they?
And this is the thing, isn't it, Julie? So of course it's helpful, I guess. You know, one of the allegations in all of this that I often put is, you know, there's loads of strategies in universities which are effectively judged on effort rather than attainment. You know, there's no underpinning data. There's often no underpinning data on mental health, for example, to demonstrate whether a university strategy is working or not. So I guess in theory this makes sense, but this approach means there'll be huge gaps in areas where, I mean, presumably for E6 at a university level, people are thinking, well, do you know what? There's a particular risk area potentially in staff student sexual misconduct with PGRs and so on and so on. Do you know what I mean? There'll be big gaps here, won't there?
Yeah, no, exactly. And as Joe said, the window that this is going to open up is actually limited. But my worry is it will create these big headlines. It will create these kind of percentage figures. You know, X number of students are without really doing the work that we all need to do. Now, I talk a lot in university work about the importance of understanding grey areas, but actually here, there are some very clear things around asymmetries of power that we all need to address. And this doesn't really seem to be getting at it. It's sort of collecting noise, but not giving us a way to really identify the issues and to actually make substantive change in there. I think there's a risk that, you know, the definitions aren't in place about what we're really looking at. And so I think this is one where I would urge, and I hope and know a lot of colleagues already doing, that universities are just doing their own work here as and when Office for Students decide what their next steps are in terms of this. Then can we get alongside? But there's so much else we need to be doing, not just now, but yesterday. This isn't a new issue for the sector, and there's much we need to do. And I think falling only into the kind of direct academic role, the sort of supervisory role, so much of the language around this, about where the problems are, they are everywhere. They're, if you're on a field trip, that it's back to grey areas, but therefore we need clear policies. And I think there's lots to learn actually from the FE sector and from schools that we would be mindful to be quite humble in this space and take that learning as quickly as possible. So I'm inclined to say there's a lot of other work that needs to be going on in a very different space around E6.
Michael, other issue, I guess, is the duty, E6 is not just about sexual misconduct and sexual harassment. It covers all sorts of harassment. And actually, not only does it cover all the sorts of harassment where someone has a protected characteristic under the Equality Act, it also covers the nature of the conduct, even if someone isn't protected with a protected characteristic under the Equality Act. What have OFS said anything about why it's only going to survey the kind of efficacy of its regulatory approach in relation to sexual misconduct?
I think they would stress that it's a pilot and they are interested in still thinking about what else can be done. I think in terms of what else can be, how else the NSS can be used. They're also thinking about, you know, do they need to change the rules on how the data is then presented by institutions? They essentially, what they've said is just, you know, we're talking about this condition around, as you say, lots of different kinds of harassment. But for them, a big driver of this was what students were saying. As you've said on the site, this is partly because this is what students were being asked about. It's partly because it's also in the press. But clearly this is to some extent, the focus on sexual misconduct is a bit of a win for the campaigning work that's been done on this issue. OFS have chosen to prioritize this rather than, say, for example, racial harassment. They could do a broader survey and it could still happen. But certainly to begin with, yeah, I think they would stress it's a pilot and they want to see how it goes, and also point out this thing about sexual misconduct being a very live issue.
Julie, I guess more broadly, this coming implementation of E6, certainly what I've been picking up around the sector is that in some cases people are, for want of a better word, tick boxing it. We already do this, we already do this, this is fine. Other providers seem to be using this as an opportunity to take a step back and actually engage quite a lot of students in that thing that we're familiar with in access and participation work, which is, you know, kind of testing out potential approaches. And there's a lot in that new duty, isn't there?
There is a lot in there, and you can probably hear in what I'm saying that certainly from where I'm sitting and with the teams, we're taking that opportunity. I think it's really important, and there's a lot we can do. You mentioned about the mental health space. I mean, in the same way that I think students are really good articulating some of the issues and the needs in here, and I have multiple examples where individual students offer me a kind of form of reverse mentoring on their journeys and their experience. This is one of those sets of experience that we need to explore. We need to work absolutely hand in glove with our student unions on this. It's often in their campaign manifestos. But I think, you know, there's something to learn about what we're saying in the mental health space, about the other services involved. This is one where the sector needs to find out better ways to work together. And there is a kind of, you know, shared data and collaboration piece here, because the sector is mobile and problems move around. And can we could have closed off a lot of issues in the past, I think, if there were more openness and honesty around the problems here, and let's own it, because this is not new to the sector. There was no golden age in this space, and we need to take this opportunity, I would say, and I would urge, you know, all of my colleagues to be doing that work.
Joe, in your in sort of your circle on the Venn diagram, there's obviously this debate now about staff-student relationships. So, I mean, OFS is, I think, fairly clear. If there's a supervisory relationship between students and staff, you know, personal tutors, dissertation supervisors or whatever, it definitely has to be, you know, I mean, OFS actually doesn't quite say definitely has to be banned, but it basically says that. Whereas there's this wider debate then about whether or not that ban should apply more widely. Now, in a big university, it strikes me that, particularly where there's franchise partnerships or years abroad or, you know, all sorts of other things that OFS will say a university has to take responsibility for, there's a potential for real complexity here, isn't there? If people have slightly different approaches for different subject areas or groups of students or satellite providers or...
I think I've read something that you wrote a while ago, Jim, saying that any sensible HR director would say something along the lines of, crikey, just ban it. And I think, so my starting point is, you had wrong when you wrote that. I think the principles are simple, right? I think intimate relationships should be banned where it's possible, avoided where it's possible. And then if it's not possible to do those things, then there's got to be mitigations in place. So the principles are really, really clear, but actually the individual situations can be complex. We think about full-time postgraduate students and some of the examples that you've given, isn't that straightforward? And also, you know, humans are humans, right? So we are talking about kind of individual situations when we're trying to apply these big principles. So I think actually some of the work is actually at the drier end of it is we're making sure that our processes are effective. One of the things that I think often gets missed is the kind of the interaction between whether they're investigation or disciplinary processes when issues involve staff and students, and those processes often don't talk to each other very effectively. And so we're actually working through individual situations and how you're going to address them when you've got two orbits in terms of processes is really challenging. And one thing that's part of it, it's certainly a small part of it, but can get really complicated, is when the sexual misconduct is in the other direction from a student to a staff member. And that can get very, very challenging when those processes don't interact with each other effectively.
But actually, Joe, while we talk about this, there is a new legal duty on employers, isn't there? At the end of this month, that is designed to cause employers to... Well, I mean, you explain it.
Well, the legal duty is around... it's a prevention duty to ensure that employees aren't exposed to sexual harassment and misconduct. So by and large, that's something that we're working through in the same... And most of our processes do tend to cover it, and there is an overlap with this duty. Where it's a bit of a challenge is where the misconduct comes from a third party, and how that actually, to my point, if it's a staff member, does a student count as a third party? What about people that come in from as contractors? So we're working that through is a challenge for all employees, but particularly in the university sector, which is a kind of confluence of students, staff, other stakeholders. It is part of the challenge.
Well, fascinating stuff. Particularly, I guess, for students' unions that might not have spotted that. There's an explainer on the site. There you go. So good. Lots of other bits and bobs on this on the site. Every week this week, though, separately, we're having a think about how things were and how things came to be. With City St George's Academic Registrar, Mike Ratcliffe, here's the hidden history of HE.
The first European university, the thing that we think of, there's a debate about whether African and Middle Eastern cities had things that are effectively universities, and seriously antedate the European university. But the thing that we think of as a university, Universitas, is a guild. And it's first set up as a guild by a bunch of law students who've gathered in Bologna. And their problems are issues with the townspeople who keep trying to fleece them.
them,
but also issues with the people who are teaching them. So the university, the guild of people in that city, is formed of the students. So it's a guild of the students. Universitas means the collection of everybody in a place doing something. You can have a universitas of cobblers. In this case, it's a universitas of students. So they set up a guild and it has a set of rules. And the rules are relatively straightforward for the students. There's a set of rules about not fighting each other, but apart from that, it's very limited in terms of student regulations. All the regulations are all about the staff. So they're all about the staff are supposed to turn up on time. There's some very strict rules about they have to start, when they have to start the lectures and when they have to finish them. And if the lecture's going on for too long, the students are obliged to get up and go to show that their displeasure at the at this kind of tardiness. There's clear rules about following the curriculum, not skimping on the hard bits, making sure the students understand the curriculum properly, and not getting into any of the dubious, teaching the coasting bits. So they've got to make that clear. Their staff have to swear allegiance to the student's rector. They aren't allowed out of town without asking permission to the students. They have to get permission to do that. And obviously, the way the staff get paid is through the student fee. So there's a clear economical link, but the students have all these rules. When you get to Northern European universities, they're more theological in focus. And so it's the bishop's chancellor who takes charge of organization. And these become master's universities. So Northern European universities are master's and scholar's universities, whereas a group of the Italian and Southern European universities are student universities. So you get this dichotomy of organizational structures.
Now, finally this week, student characteristics data for the 2024 National Student Survey has emerged. Joe, what is it telling us?
Yep, hold the front page. It's the characteristics data from the MSA. So the OFS, I think it's from the second year. Certainly, they did do it last year. Released results from the National Student Survey, and they split it by certain student characteristics. So although the OFS haven't released a commentary, there's some interesting information you can glean from it. Perhaps not particularly new information. David's got a blog on the site which provides a tool to kind of look at the data and provide some initial insight. So when you do look at it on a high level, you can see that, for example, students with disabilities are more likely to feel dissatisfied with their experience in general, and they seem to be quite most stark in relation in questions that relate to student voice. So that's obviously underlining a challenge that we probably know about already. Jim, you identified last year when you were looking at the data that breaking down the freedom of speech question by these characteristics really help us understand it a bit better and challenging some of the assumptions and the rhetoric around the freedom of speech issue. So I think, while it is useful, I think its use is a little bit limited. Firstly, can't really look at it from an intersectional perspective, and I think that would really help. And although individual universities can sort of look at their data in a bit more detail, what we can't do is sort of see the breakdown by individual institutions, which kind of limits our ability to kind of identify trends, but most important to kind of understand the effect of interventions that we could make in the sector and an institutional perspective.
Now, Michael, Joe obviously was joking when he said hold the front page, but it is notable, isn't it? There's not even any commentary from OFS, either that usual stuff where it finger wags at universities, or even some commentary perhaps that would cause it to think about what it should do in its plans and regulation in response.
Yeah, I guess that's true. We know that the Office for Students is at the moment sort of putting the finishing touches, we think, on their sort of next big multi-year strategy, and which will go out for consultation fairly soon, we think. And they have been saying for quite a few months now, this is really going to be aiming at sort of getting students back into the heart of it yet again. You would think that this kind of data on how different student groups actually experience and respond to and feel about their courses is something that should be at the heart of a strategy in some way. It's, you know, it's not just about outcomes, right? It's not just about continuation, progression, and so on. There should be things about student experience. But, it's true. And Joe mentioned the freedom of speech question. I think this is quite a clear example, or at least it has been in the past, but with the last government. So, we get the results in the summer. We see for the last 2 years, we've seen sort of 13 or 14% of students answer negatively to the question about whether they felt free to express their ideas. It doesn't really tell us anything. I mean, how are students interpreting that question? What are are the actual facts on the grounds that 13 or 14% reflects. Not sure. But that, in the past at least, has been accompanied by commentary from Arif Ahmed, for example, the director of free speech, saying, you know, 1 in 7 students unable to express themselves. This demonstrates that freedom of speech legislation is needed, a new complaint scheme is needed. I mean, obviously, he didn't comment in this summer, but, you know, we've seen this statistic be used for regulatory purposes, you know, but both this year and last year in October, we get this characteristics data, which, as you have pointed out in previous blogs, and we can see it again in yesterday's data, when we look at this free speech question by student characteristics, you know, we do see things like for a start, we don't see anything about, like, you know, politics in here. We can't make a judgment about, is this right-wing or left-wing students being censored? You know, but we do see that students with mental health conditions, disabilities, Asian students are more likely to be more negative about this thing about, can they freely express their views? And there's no commentary on that. That fact doesn't get into the sort of wider discourse. It's not mentioned by, you know, people in parliament. It doesn't get into the papers. And probably it should. You know, it is equally important, even if it doesn't really still tell us anything, because, as Joe said, we can't cross-reference this with other characteristics. So we don't know how it's being influenced by, you know, say, for example, Asian students are slightly less positive, although they're still pretty positive overall about freedom to express themselves. But how is this slice of students being influenced by, you know, their educational background or their family wealth or their class or their religion? We've no idea.
And, you know, certainly for me, it's doubly frustrating because OFS is sat on, you know, well over a decade's worth of free text comments that it has a couple of times promised that it would analyse and publish reports on, but seemingly never does. And presumably, given how late that question is in the survey, that some of the free text comments would at least, you know, qualify some of the responses. Julie, I guess the other thing that, you know, we're a couple of three years into seeing this data now, and consistently every year on pretty much every question, international students are scoring higher. Now, is that international students having a glorious time, or are there some problems here in terms of a kind of lack of proper cognitive testing by different characteristics?
I think we've got to be honest with ourselves and try and dig into the latter possibility. And I think, you know, going back to Joe's point, you know, we really need an intersectional approach in trying to think just that big basket that says international students. That can mean very different things. Actually, we're talking a lot about commuter students as one of the kind of key things, but actually a lot of our international students are commuter students traveling from diasporic communities in Southwest London. How does that play out for them? And then actually, you know, international students is just too monolithic a concept, and because actually the relational complexities of that are massive, and we need to understand. I mean, it's all about, for me, you know, we are constantly and rightly asking ourselves as institutions, how can we begin to be where our very different students need us to be and to be there differently, if you like. But the risk of this, you know, we will use the data and we continue to. I suppose it is confirmatory rather than revelatory in many ways. But it does feel like the risk of a data dump here. And with colleagues who are very pressured working in different teams, there's a lack of trust sometimes in the data. And your point about free text is really important, because I've spent a lot of time going through all of our free text comments across our 6 academic.
Yeah, once you start, you can't stop, can you?
It is really revealing. And if you've done it over a couple of years, as I've now done here, you can see those patterns and trends and issues start to come through. And that intersectionality is to the fore. People are juggling multiple things on different fronts. And that's where we really need the help to be able to dig in. Now, of course, the mental health teams are working with, so they are looking at the kinds of statistics that Joe and Michael have already mentioned, and that work's going on, the question around freedom of speech. But there's something deeper in here that the, you know, the polar quintile work doesn't get at, that the free text work could actually, that longitudinal work could really give us something to get our hands around as a sector.
Joe, I guess the other thing nationally is, I mean, we've already talked about, you know, it's quite an expensive exercise, this. We've already talked about, you know, the lack of coverage of, you know, PGRs, PGTs, new students and so on. But one of the things I was reading about 6:15 this morning for all sorts of strange reasons was the Finnish student health survey, right? And there are some fascinating both questions and results in there. And they do that every couple of years. And, you know, one of the things I keep coming back to is, given how, you know, the movements for individual institutions are really tiny, often, year to year, do we really need to be doing this every year? And if not, could we be using, you know, kind of national survey capacity for, you know, some of the other things that we apparently don't have time or, you know, can't afford to ask about?
Well, firstly, I'm feeling stupid for not reading the Finnish Student Health Survey preparation for this podcast. I'm feeling deeply underprepared. But
link in the show notes, as ever.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I guess my initial thought is the body that's responsible for regulation the kind of the body that's probably best geared up to actually generating the best type of student insight that we need? Because obviously there's a kind of a dual purpose there. The second thought is, I'm not sure Ginny would say the same, we do a lot of work institutionally to kind of get student insight. So the national picture is only one different element of that. But I think your broad point is right. There's probably, going back to what we were saying in the previous item, in terms of what we think, what is the use case for the data that we generate? What are we actually going to do with it? What challenges does the sector really want to address? And actually having an insight strategy that's driven by those desired outcomes, as opposed to the starting point being the predilections of the regulatory body.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to go in deep on anything we've discussed today, including the Finnish Student Health Survey. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget to subscribe. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to get ahead of everything going on in UKHE, do click subscriptions on the site to find out more. So thanks very much to Julie, Joe, Michael, who also makes the show happen. We'll be back next week. Mark will be here. Until then, stay wonky.